Why is it we humans get romanced by complexity when the answers can be found at a simple and practical level? This is the Simply Practically Human podcast, where the human manager, Mark Labasque, features experts who have a track record in humanizing workplaces, using simplicity and practicality as their go-to approach. It's all about getting back to what it is to be human and watch workplaces thrive rather than just survive.
Hey there, it's Mark Labasque for the Simply Practically Human podcast. And I was joined today by Audrey McGibbon, who, strangely enough, around 10 or 11 years ago, we first met. And Audrey was working as an executive coach at the time. And I had the pleasure of being one of her clients. And one of the things that struck me about Audrey was her ability to, first of all, build trust very, very quickly, which then enabled her to ask the questions that, if I look back in hindsight now, I didn't really want to answer, but I felt that working with such a beautiful human being, that her willingness to invest in me would mean that I should really invest in myself and answer those questions. So she was very, very instrumental in helping me to make some decisions that have ultimately found me where I am today. So I really, really wanted to get her on. And, you know, Audrey has been working in this sort of space around psychology and as a researcher around well-being for over 30 years. And these days, and I won't give too much away, but she's created some amazingly practical diagnostics that organizations can use. And one of the things I really love about her is she's used herself as a bit of an experiment in well-being and to delve into how she could turn up the best possible version of herself to create that credibility to help others do the same thing. So she's going to share some really interesting tips today around what can you do to enhance your own well-being and also to help others with that. And, you know, one of the things she does share is that it does start with self. And Audrey asks some really, really challenging questions in here that you need to put to yourself before you can start to help others, which I think you'll find not just challenging, but also very insightful that you'll get those things. I love that when she talked about there's no shortcut to this and that, you know, it takes time, and she'll delve into that a little bit further. She'll share some of her very, very personal stories, which I found quite interesting of her growing up and how they have all had something to do with her ending up where she is today as, you know, one of the leading experts in this space of well-being. So sit back, have a listen, take some notes. There'll also be some details around where you can find her, her website, which has got a whole lot of information. She has an amazing blog you should check out as well. Have a listen, and we'll catch you at the end of the episode. I'm delighted to be joined today by Audrey McGibbon, who's a psychologist and researcher, and for 30 years or so has been really looking into the topic of well-being and how to help other human beings to exist in a world where, you know, well-being at times gets put to the back of the queue. So Audrey, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Mark.
Before we kick into this amazing topic, and we're going to go to some places today that usually people wouldn't go to, because we're going to call some bullshit on what goes on in this space of well-being, particularly in organizations. But before we go there, I want you to tell the story of how we first connected way back, I think, 10 years ago now.
You're asking a big question there, Mark, because my memory is so bad. But I do remember some very deep and meaningful conversations when you were in your other life in the corporate world and you were contemplating what direction and path that you were going to be taking. And so we first met, as I recall, in my capacity as an executive coach.
That's exactly right. So you were coaching me, and I remember we used to meet and I'd come out of the end of those things. Look, it was a very, very rich experience, but I remembered I'd be totally buggered because the sorts of questions that you asked me really held me to account, which I'm grateful for, because in essence, you're one of the people who has helped me get into my other life now by continually challenging me to think about, you know, are you really doing what you want to do? And, you know, you talk about that sort of 30 years of helping individuals, and you certainly helped me. So I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, it's a big question, isn't it? So one of my favorite coaching questions is, okay, I'm pretty clear I can understand what the organization gets out of having you do the job that you do, but I'm less clear about what needs you have that are being met by doing what you're doing. So can you think about how does what you're doing meet what you need?
Yeah.
And that usually floors people.
Usually because we try and avoid that sort of work. It's easy to do the other work where we don't have to ask ourselves and answer the questions that we don't want to answer. And I think one of the beauties in my experience and through connecting with you is that you ask the questions that people need to answer. And if you're prepared to hold your nerve and sit with them, I think you can come out the other end of it pretty well. So thanks again. So let's get into this topic of well-being. Just before we get a bit more of your backstory, as someone who's been in this space for some time and is an expert in it, what does well-being mean to you?
Well, actually, I'll answer that by going back to what you just said about I ask the hard questions that people don't really like to consider. And so actually, they're not really the hard questions. What's really hard is when you just go through life and you don't question, you don't pause and think, well, what's going on for me beneath the kind of immediately conscious level in our brains where we're thinking about, you know, what needs to be done and what our boss wants and, you know, how our team needs and what's going on in the family and la, la, la. We got all get caught up in that. And that's actually the hard way to exist. The easier way to exist is when we're sort of working in collaboration with our subconscious, our biology, our kind of emotional life, which sits underneath the surface. So what's really hard is to stay at that logical, kind of factual, task-based level when, for many people, because of the crazy world that we live in these days, the gap between kind of what our executive logical brains are telling us and what our emotional needs are is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's kind of deceptive. It feels easy to stay in those kind of like what needs to be done level questions. But really the easy life, the life where there's contentment and fulfillment and where we feel like we're both kind of got pleasure from the sense of there's nice things in our life, but pleasure from the sense of growing and doing stuff that's rewarding and fulfilling. And it's the absence of feeling miserable and stressed and tired and knackered. So that's the stuff that feels easy. So well-being is that state of ease where our logical, rational brains are connected to what's going on for us underneath the surface in terms of our emotional needs as well. And when we don't have well-being, it's usually because of this huge gap and growing gulf between our outside expressions and what's going on for us on the inside. Is that too much of psychobabble for you, Mark?
No, not at all. I'm sitting here because I'm just, as you know, I'm a pretty simple sort of a human being. I thought well-being was going to the gym three times a week and doing some crunches and stuff like that. So I actually... That makes a lot of sense, and I'm sure people will be thinking, I've never thought of it that way. But the psychobabble's good, by the way. We need some psychobabble from you today, also to sit with some of the other stuff we're going to share.
So I'll just jump in. I think that's one of the things is everybody talks about well-being, but it is at that surface level, and it does mean to most people, and even I refer to it sometimes as the kind of the gym, the yoga, the apples, the eating healthy, and I'm not knocking that stuff, and that's really good. But the psychological kind of basis of well-being is where we're in that sweet spot between the resources that we have available to us on our insides, our psychological, emotional, social, physical, mental resources, and when they are commensurate with the amount of challenge that's coming at us in life. And therefore, it's a much more dynamic thing because of that. It's not just, I mean, you could go to the gym 100 times a week and actually still have low levels of well-being. And we see that with a lot of the ultra fit, ultra warriors from the sports world who don't have good mental health.
Absolutely. It's certainly seeing a lot of that at the moment. So let's delve a little bit into your backstory, because I'm sure there'll be some curiosity around people listening and hearing a bit of an accent. So maybe a bit about where you grew up and some of your early influences. Could you share a bit of that?
Hi, Mark. I can. I grew up in a very, very small little Scottish village, idyllic. My father was the local village policeman. I lived in the police house in a little village called Loch Earnhead. We had a cell in the police station house, which I was, you know, I think my father always threatened to lock me up and put me in it, but I don't think he actually did to my memory. But it was an interesting life. And we looked out over the loch, and my first school had 11 pupils in the whole school. And my teacher used to bring her dogs into the classroom. It was fantastic, apart from the fact the dogs used to eat my lunch, but that was also okay because I wasn't really too keen on the pet lunches. So that was where I grew up. And my first sort of traumatic memory was of being told one day, that's it, we're moving to the city. Dad had had a bad accident and he was no longer able to do all the stuff that a Highlands policeman was required to do, like climb hills and chase criminals up mountains and stuff. So he went to a desk-based job with still with the police in the local city, which, you know, you would have thought you were dropping me into New York. With I know now that that town only had, I think it was about 50,000 people in the whole town. In my world, that was a metropolis. And that was traumatic, you know, in the sense that trauma is where, you know, we experience stressful things, but we have no control over them. I was five, and absolutely zero control. And I understand, of course, why my parents had to do it, but that was trauma. Didn't like it at all.
And so you went from how many people in the small, in the village, how many, what was the population there?
Well, it was transient because in the summer it would swell. It was a real water skiing, you know, mecca, but sort of stable population, probably, I don't know, 400.
Wow, we, so 400 to 50,000. Then so the formative years of your life then, as in schooling and those things, happened in the bigger town?
In the bigger town. And I was, you know, it's interesting for me, Mark. So as an adult, I've been diagnosed with ADHD, and there was no sign of that as a child, other than the fact that my adult recollection is of being completely bored and having a thousand different hobbies on the go. So I was into music. I did ice skating. I played, you know, a number of different instruments. I had, you know, hobbies up the yin yang.
Yeah.
And was still bored. But it was also bored in that idyllic sense of being bored. You know, it was kind of like, it was an easy child. It's the childhood that I wish that I was able to give my kids, but I can't. Mm. Just lots of downtime, none of the tech, loving grandparents. I mean, you sort of early influences are a loving family. Mm. And for that, I'm really blessed. It's something everybody has.
And so what led you down the path? You talk about, you know, the psychologist, the researcher stuff. What led you down that path?
Okay, so I did pretty well at school. I left school early at 17, went off to university to study law because, you know, my parents were working class and nobody in our family before my brother and I had gone to university. Oh, actually, that's not true. My uncle did. Anyway, it was a big deal to go to uni. And of course, my parents were thrilled with the idea that they might have a lawyer in the family. And I phoned home in the first week at uni and said, oh, by the way, Mom, Dad, I've got some news. I'm not going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a psychologist. There was just this sort of shocked silence on the phone. I think they were crushed, but they're such lovely people. They were like, well, darling, are you sure? Are you going to get a job as a psychologist? I'm not sure. What is a psychologist exactly, darling? And I said, oh, okay, right. I might not get a job. I'll tack on a commerce degree. So I did psychology and business at uni, which in those days, back in the dark ages, you know, that was a pretty novel combination. Nowadays, it's pretty sensible. But that was the pathway into organizational psychology. And I did that and I bluffed my way into a fantastic graduate position with a company called SHL, which again, in the late 80s, early 90s, was the world's leading business developing assessment and development tools for use with adults in the workplace. And that was what I did. And I loved it and had a great 5 years there. They were growing around the world. I came over to Australia for a year's secondment. That was in 96 and I never went back.
Wow. So home now is Sydney, yeah?
Home is Sydney. My spiritual home is Sydney and Edinburgh combined.
Nice.
It's where most of my growth occurred, with Loch Earnhead as my screensaver. That's where I remind myself of every day.
So lawyer for a few days, psychologist into commerce, now in Australia. And, you know, my experience with you as I met you, you know, 10 or 11 years ago was as this incredible coach. What is taking you sort of down the pathway to get into that coaching space? And then the other thing that comes with that is into that sort of coaching around elements of well-being. What drove you down that path?
So the really kind of short story is the first half of my 30 years was spent assessing executives and doing that really well. And that was quite satisfying because there's a lot of shit out there in terms of how people do get assessed. So it was kind of really good to do it with some great quality tools. But it was always left with me about, well, so what? So we run the ruler over people. Well, what is that? How is that really helping them achieve their best? And so when my family came along, and by that time I was managing director of the business in Australia and doing a lot of travel across the Asia-Pac region, and it just was a bit of an epiphany around, you know what, I can't actually carry on doing the pretty much 24/7 rostering of being on for work and look after this much wanted and hard to come by baby that come into my life. And I just thought, sod it, I'm going to go out on my own and do my own tiny little bit of consulting and coaching work. And I'm going to focus on the stuff that goes beyond simply assessing and evaluating and measuring and monitoring people to actually trying to shift them right up as far up the curve as they want to go and can go. So that was what I did. It was a combination of, I suppose, a little bit of my own first taste of burnout, which I didn't realize that's what it was at the time, but I was a bit jaded in what I had been doing. And also it just wasn't sustainable. So I wanted to rebalance things in my life.
So just on that, and in the essence of thinking of well-being, and you said you didn't realize it at the time, but it might have been your first sort of foray into burnout. What is it that you know now that would tell that person back then that it was burnout that they couldn't see?
Okay, so huge levels of fatigue, which was more than just having had a one-year-old baby. Fatigue at the prospect of going into the office. An increasing sense of detachment and not really caring about what was going on. And an example of that would be, I remember distinctly one day somebody in my team saying, oh, look, can you have a word with this, summarized as very tricky client who's griping about something. And I remember having a conversation with that person that, frankly, if I'd heard any of my team members talking like that to them, I would have had to sack them. It was absolutely outrageous. It was more or less, well, listen, lady, if you don't like the way that we're selling this or you don't like our pricing, you can go and use something else that's pretty crap. So thank you, goodbye, and hung up. And I thought, okay, that's really not okay. It's time to move on. And how I realized was when I stepped away from that role, the quality of what occurred for me in my life, the quality of my sleep, the quality of my connection with my family, friends. I remember walking down the street one day and seeing people sitting on a park drinking coffees and chatting. And I remember feeling outraged, really angry about why did nobody tell me that this was what was possible in life? Mm. Because I had by then spent 12 years just 10, 12, 15 hour days, 6, 7 days a week.
Yeah. And I guess that there'll be many people who'll be listening to this who can resonate with that sort of thing. It's that looking at others and going, how the bloody hell have they got that when I'm, up to my ass in meetings and reports and all these sorts of things. So that let that bring us into this dear thing we call the corporate world, which we've had many, many conversations. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, we had a ripper, which we'll revisit some of that stuff today. Maybe I need to go to more of an optimistic view on this stuff than what I have, but I do have some views that organisations pay scant regard to well-being, and they usually do it when it becomes a bit of a fad or they want to keep up with the Joneses, some other organisation or something happens like that. But I want you to tell me a little bit about what sort of organisations do this well-being stuff well? What sets them apart from the others that are doing it more as a compliance or tick-the-box activity?
The ones that are doing it well know that it takes a real effort from the very top to the very bottom of the organization in that sort of hierarchical way. But in other words, if I express it in a less linear way, it's an organization that enlists everyone in the challenge of what do we have to do together individually as teams? How do we have to kind of get our leaders to be thinking? What do we have to do in the way of supporting with policies and the right procedures? What do we all have to do to play our part to become a place where when we come in, actually it feels pretty good, whether that's in the virtual in or in the physical office. But it feels good and it's a place where we want to be, and where one of my most fantastic clients is the CFO of a giant organization, and he talks about, Audrey, for me, well-being, our commitment to well-being is we make sure that by the time every employee comes to leave our organization, they feel that they themselves are net positive as a result of working with us, that they have grown in life, not just in a bank balance way, but they have grown in life and it's been a net positive. And for me, those are the organizations that are doing it well, where they're really sort of saying, look, people spending so much time working, how can we make this not just the statutory obligation to make sure that we don't inflict psychological harm on people, but how can we make it almost joyous? And I remember the first time I talked about making work joyous about 5 years ago, and people were just like wetting themselves laughing. Like, ha, 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 very funny. I was like, it's really not funny. That's where we're going to have to get to, because the world is hard at the moment.
Yeah.
So we need something that brings us a level of absorption and pleasure and satisfaction and fulfillment. So how do we do that where technology is turning everything on its head, where we're restructuring constantly, when we often feel we don't have the right level of resources to give us the capacity to deliver on what's expected of us? So for me, it's not a silly question. It's one that we really need to face into. And so the organizations that do it well are doing that, Mark.
It's interesting, you know, you say joyous. I remember back when I was catching up with you in my former life that at one stage I asked my team this question. I flipped some things around and I asked them what they enjoyed at work and what they achieved outside of work. And they didn't quite know how to answer because their brains weren't wired that way. They were like, hang on, enjoyment happens outside of work and achievement happens inside. But by starting to get them to think about that, I think it started to help them get to what you were talking about, that actually work can be joyous, work can be fun, and you can actually feel like coming to work if, as you said, you're getting, you know, the person in charge of your team or in charge of the business all the way through having a very, very different view around this. So let's go to the other side of it. You know, these bottom-feeding tokenistic types that...
Say what you mean.
Well, they shit me to tears, I got to say. You know, people, like, come and do a lunch and learn and we'll bring someone in and we'll get them to talk to you about eating the five different food colours. And we're all sitting there eating our McDonald's or whatever we've rushed out and got out of the machine that's the vending machine. And then we listen and we all get inspired and then we walk out. And then someone in the HR department goes to that sheet they've got and ticks the box and goes, yep, we've done that one. You beauty.
Yeah, you cynic, you.
Oh, I know. What do you think?
Well, the other one that I see a lot, I mean, I don't think there's bad intention. I think most organisations, even the ones that you might sort of feel are the bottom feeders, I feel that they believe that they are sincere in their intention to treat well-being as a priority. But I just think there's a lack of rigour in them confronting what that means. If it is really a priority in the way that any other strategic initiative was going to be a priority, that would mean resources, investment, time. It would mean holding people to account on it. It would mean making sure your leaders at all levels are on the same song sheet. And none of that stuff is really happening in the organizations where they've got this beautiful kind of statement around well-being and it being a place where, you know, sustainable high performance well-being, blah, 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 blah. But that is not then the lived reality. And a practical example for me would be coaching a senior person recently who said, no, the team's going really well. And I said, oh, how did you know that? He said, oh, well, we always make a point of checking in at team meeting. We say, you know, how's everybody's well-being? And I'm like, seriously, do you expect people to say, oh, yeah, excuse me, on a, you know, webinar with 30 odd people in it, including their boss and their boss's boss? Oh, yeah, no, excuse me, my well-being's not so great. I said, make no bones about it. At the end of that call, in a group of 30, you will have at least five people who pretty much hang up and put their head in their hands and go, you know, thank Christ, that's over. I can't do this anymore.
Yep.
It's a bit shocked. And then I said, so tell me more about that meeting. He said, well, you know, we do the well-being bit. And I did say to someone, I said, gosh, are you okay? Because you're looking, you know, I'm a bit concerned about you and I've heard that you're not feeling so well. And I had that conversation and they were like, no, I'm good. And then I said, okay, so then what did the meeting go to? He said, well, we just went back to, you know, what needs to be delivered. And I said, so do you get that when somebody is saying they need some space and their well-being isn't great, that there then is a choice that you can't just say, oh, I'm sorry you're feeling not so great, but could you deliver that piece of work for me by 5 o'clock tonight? Otherwise, we're in big shit.
Yeah, that infuriates me because that's the compliance-based piece. You know, particularly in the times we're in today, Audrey, and we've been in these times for, you know, 6 or 7 months now, and it all sort of started very well and people were checking in and... But you talked about time before, and let's just explore this bit a little bit here because this isn't a set and forget thing where you go, you know, let's focus in on it in our meeting once a week. We'll give 3 minutes to it. How's your well-being? Yeah, everyone's okay. Let's get on with it. This isn't set and forget. This is like every time you catch up with your people. My sense is that this conversation needs to happen. And as a manager, you need to be a little bit more tuned into what's going on than just ask the question because you have to, and then move on. What is it just that we don't have enough time or that there are things that are more important in the corporate world than well-being?
Both of those. And then I think with the well-being and mental health space, there is also that additional challenge around, well, I do genuinely want to support my team or my colleagues or my family's well-being. I'm actually really quite unsure about the best way to do that. So it comes almost back to a conversational skill. How do we talk about well-being? How do we talk about mental health? Do you just pitch up and say, hey, Mark, how's your well-being today? Or do we have to be a little bit more subtle or cunning or hey, you like this, Mark? Treat people as humans and recognize that each person might need something a little bit different. So the standard patter of, hey, everyone, let's talk about our well-being is going to sit really well with some people and say, sure, I'll talk about that. And with others, please shoot me. You know, I'd rather have my eyeballs poked out than talk about my well-being with you in this way.
So just on that too, and I sometimes I do forget, because I was one as well as you were, but managers and the senior people in businesses and organizations are humans as well. So they need to be focused on their well-being. How can you help? How do you help managers to understand that if they're not focusing in on their well-being, that that's going to have an impact on others as well? What's the relationship there, do you think, around if I'm really focused in on my own well-being, I'm very aware and doing the things I need to be doing, versus me just working 16, 17-hour days and walking around dragging my knuckles, what's the difference there?
So that's exactly where I've been focusing these last 5 years, in that if my vision is to create a world where every employee's well-being is supported better and every employee has the possibility of enhancing their well-being rather than having work destroy it, then the way I felt that I could contribute most to that was to work at the top of organizations and really try and, in some cases, wake people up and wake the whole organization up to the need for this. But increasingly, it's around switching them on at a deeper level to what they need as individuals, as leaders themselves. So the whole self-care piece, which, you know, a lot of really high achievers at the top of organizations, they've got very high levels of resilience. But the thing that they seldom are aware of is that no matter how resilient, every single resilient person on this planet has a finite capacity that they will one day get to. And just going back to my opening remarks about the logical brain and the emotional brain, one day after years and years and years and years and years and years and years of ignoring your subconscious kind of needs and emotions, that will just kind of come home to roost. And one day you will not be in great shape. So what I have worked out is that in order to enhance well-being in organizations, there's four things that need to happen. We need to switch leaders on by helping them learn actually what we mean by well-being and mental health and similarities and differences and how to talk about it and what the models are and what drives it and all those things, so that we get underneath the bonnet of just this kind of lip service stuff that goes on. So they have to learn it and then they have to live it. And I think that was your point. It's that the leaders that are really living it and role modeling and they're switched on to it, they then get that it's not as simple as saying, okay, we'll put on lunch and learn sessions or yoga classes or whatever. It's actually about each individual taking the time to think about their own personal situation, because none of us walk in an identical pair of shoes when we think about the circumstances that we're dealing with in life and who we are as individuals. So it's a unique formula that each of us has. And so when you've got a group of leaders, and I work with them using a really sort of thorough diagnostic, which is my research tool, the GLWS, and it's a really thorough piece when we then debrief and we talk about it, it gets you into some pretty deep conversations. And it's really about each of us needing to work out our own precise recipe. So I know, for example, Mark, I know I need to be reading novels. That's my early warning signal. If I stop reading a novel, then it's my cue to, or my warning, early warning signal telling me that my stress levels are going up, because it's a thing that brings me pleasure. Anyway, so each of us needs to figure out precisely what it is that we need and acknowledge that shifts and changes. So learn it and then live it. And only when you've done those two things are they in a semi-decent position to even try to lead it. And the relationship between leaders who have high levels of well-being is that they cast a much more positive well-being shadow across the organization, and how the leader shows up impacts the well-being of their followers. And that is fairly conclusively positioned from the research that we've got on this.
So just with your research then, and just you just mentioned it before, a diagnostic, can you talk a little bit now about the diagnostic? And if someone is curious to know more about the diagnostic, where could they find some things out about it? What does it do and where can they find it?
Thanks, Mark. Probably the easiest thing is just to jump onto glwswellbeing.com. There's heaps and heaps of information on there, or just shoot me an email on audrey@glwswellbeing.com. And the tool, I developed the tool going back to my life as an executive coach, because I had this moment as a coach going, crap, you know, I can't help these people be better leaders or more strategic or better engaging their people until I've really understood and help them understand what's going on for them in a holistic way, both in their work lives, their professional lives, and their personal lives, and pulled it all together to look at their resources and where they're depleted and where they need support. And some of those can be really quite subtle things. Not every leader is a basket case and languishing and struggling and about to kind of have a breakdown, but even people who are at the more thriving end of things, they need to understand, well, what's their secret sauce for helping them thrive, and what can they never compromise on in order to sustain that for themselves? So for me, I wanted something to get into that really deep stuff quite quickly, and I couldn't find a tool. And so hence I married my background in psychometrics and assessments with now my desire to do something in the wellbeing space. So I created this tool. It's not rocket science, but it's well researched, and I know it taps into the factors that drive wellbeing for leaders in organizations, and they really relate to it because the language that I use means it gets buy-in. Because a lot of the tools that I looked at, I was like, oh my God, I cannot put that in front of a senior leader. They just wet themselves laughing or just throw it out as being, you know, psychobabble. And it's not a clinical screening tool. We don't want to wait until people are sick and anxious and depressed and, you know, kind of really fallen apart. This is something that is like an early warning process.
So there's the tool itself. Now, am I right in saying you also have a process where people can become accredited to use that tool? Is that correct?
That's right, for people like you and me. So anybody who's interested in working and supporting humans to be well, function, perform at high standards, but don't see well-being as something that they have to sacrifice in order to achieve performance. So yeah, run accreditation. And these days, we've been doing it online for a while, pre-COVID, but it's pretty slick now, I have to say. So yeah, got about 380 people accredited worldwide using the tool happily, and that's great. We have got lots of psychologists and HR people and executive coaches. We also have people who have got strong backgrounds in the well-being space, but we actually turn away people who are just coming to it from a personal training perspective. The key thing for us, Mark, is that they're individuals who, they don't have to be experts in well-being. They have to be really skilled at having and holding the space for deep and meaningful, constructive, positive conversations with senior people in organizations. So it's really around, what's your experience there? And are you prepared for a conversation where you might be discussing quite deeply personal things with people for a reason? You're not, you know, they're a counselor. So that's really what we look for, Mark. And we do recognize a lot of different disciplines and professions that come to us. And it's really about what they want to do with it. The one thing we're adamant about is it will not be used for any selection or assessment purposes.
Lovely. And so people can find that again on your website?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So you mentioned COVID before. And as I go into, I think, week 15 of lockdown now in Melbourne, which seems, I thought the time would go slowly. The time seems to have flown. Let's get to this idea of some three simple and practical tools and tips that you can share for managers or just for humans today that can help to get people through this time with a greater focus on the well-being of your team or the well-being of yourself. What would be three simple or practical things that could be helpful here?
For me, the one at the top of the list is just to ask yourself, are you treating yourself in the way that you would like your loved ones to be treating themselves?
Nice.
So that often makes people pause. The other one is, if you carry on as you are and getting up and going through your day in the ways that you're going through your day, how will you be? And in the COVID context, it might be, how will you be 3 weeks from now or 6 weeks from now or 3 months from now if you carry on as you are? Pre-COVID, I used to sort of put a longer timeline on that and say, so if you change nothing, what will life be like for you and how will you be 2 or 3 years from now? And again, that's that kind of enforcing the pause and the reflection for positive, well-intentioned reasons to help people surface some of that stuff that sits beneath their conscious awareness on a day-to-day basis. And the third one is the one I've already mentioned, is you have to put the work in to figuring out what is your secret sauce, your secret formula. So I can tell you the six broad factors in well-being. It's about your social relationships, the extent to which you've got meaning, purpose, and clear direction in life, the extent to which you've got strong resilience and emotional evenness on the inside, the amount of energy that you feel. So what are you doing to look after your physical vitality and energy, your intellectual engagement and flow? And then how are you organizing your life in terms of looking at allocating your energy and your time and the pace and rhythm of your day? So that's that balance and boundaries piece. So those are the six factors that everyone needs. We know that. We all need it. But what precisely is your formula? It's like they're all the core ingredients, but how are you going to assemble them? What's important to you, and how do you need to adapt that recipe over time? And that bit takes work, Mark. There's no shortcut. We can't borrow somebody else's recipe. It doesn't work. And so that's one thing, is not to just send yourself into a state of distraction by trying to emulate what everybody else is doing. You know, the 5-2 diet, I find high intensity interval training works for me. I like reading novels. Somebody else does this. No, sorry, you just have to do the work yourself. And that sounds a bit hard, but it's the cruel to be kind message.
Yeah, I like it. So it sounds like it's got to start with self. It's got to start with you before you can. Oh, I've seen this and I've been this as well. It's like telling my people to work less hours and to do this and do that, but actually not demonstrating that. So really starting with you, I'm picking up from those great questions that you, are you treating yourself like you treat your loved ones? And there's no shortcut to it. You've really got to sit down and do a bit of diagnostic on yourself and ask yourself some, I'd say some pretty challenging questions that we tend not to do. I love that. So it takes me to this idea of simple versus complex. A question that I ask all of my guests, because it irks me that we spend so much time in, I think, chasing the complexities, whatever they are. Maybe they make us look good, or we can get in the right room with the right people. I'm interested in your thoughts on this, because your thoughts may not be the same as mine, and that's okay. Is that I think that we chase complexity, we're romanced by it when the answers are simply there in front of us in most situations. What are your thoughts around that, Audrey?
I'm irky because my particular theme at the moment is actually inverting that. It's saying, could organizations stop viewing well-being as this really simple thing that you can do, tick a box, and we just put on gym classes and everybody needs to know that they do the 10,000 steps a day and they get 7 to 9 hours sleep a night and they must be respectful in their relationships. We know all this stuff. And yet why are we still in, sort of generally speaking, a very challenging, if not bad state? So I am trying to say, from an organization perspective, it is more complex than they might tend to think. Now, if it was being addressed at the right levels in a truly strategic way, it really wouldn't be complex. It becomes complex when you tuck it into the health and safety and well-being team and say, right, fix well-being for the organization. That level of simplicity doesn't work. But if it was being addressed right at the top, then of course it's not the most complex challenge in the world there, but it's really me saying, look, I have this little model I talk about, whose responsibility is well-being, and I talk about the TOILS framework, where T is teams, O is organization, I is the individual, L is the leadership, and S is the society and government influences. And we have to recognize that all of those forces contribute to how we feel and our overall levels of well-being. And so it is too simple to say it's up to the individual, because Mark, you could be making 100% of the right decisions. Indeed, you probably are. But in, you know, actually, you've just given me a great example. You're in week 14 of lockdown, which is a government decision, which has an impact on your well-being. So we do need everybody to do their part and play nicely. And that's where I think the complexity comes in. Yep. And I'd love to switch people on to thinking about it as being, it isn't the simplicity of the wellness, you know, sleep, exercise. It's about how do we drive culture change, behavior change, societal change? How do we rebalance our priorities? And that's complex as any piece of organizational change is complex, but it's also as simple as any other change. So
I actually like it. I like what you said there about, let's just give it to the HR team or to whatever it might be, because that's where it sort of fits, or it goes into safety and then they can run it. And yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And this strong message that keeps coming through from you and here, and I think this is one for everyone to take heed to, is that this stuff has to start at the top. I'm getting a strong sense. And obviously in the work you've done, when you've seen it work well, it's tended to start at the top.
Yeah, because you really end up switching people on. They have the aha moment around, oh, crap, I get it now. So I understand and I'm looking after myself better. So they understand the benefits for them and they see the benefits for their performance and they see how they show up. So there's the personal kind of connection between, oh, actually, well-being isn't something I have to sacrifice in the pursuit of high performance. Well-being is something that will enable me to sustain me being a high achiever over a much longer period of time. So that's the take. But then it's also they're like in a much stronger position to be credible. Because to your earlier comments, it really doesn't cut the mustard when your boss says to you, oh, you know, well-being is really important, so make sure you take next Friday off. And then, you know, your boss is still sending emails at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday night.
Yep.
So if you're not walking the talk, it really doesn't cut the mustard. And yet the answer to that is not as simple as banning, having an email policy that bans emails at 6 o'clock at night, because that's another example of where simplicity actually doesn't work. That does as much harm as it does good.
Just on that email, when I remember talking to a group I was working with, and we talk about this idea of what do we do to impress people? And there are ways, even if they do have a ban an email policy, there are actually ways, and you can set your systems up so you can't send them. However, people have found ways to hack the system to say that they can still send things at 2 o'clock in the morning to look like they're impressing people. I find that hard to understand. Hey, I hope you don't mind me saying this one. People can't see you, but I can see you because we're on Zoom. You look amazing at the moment. You look super fit. You're glowing and all that sort of stuff. What have you been doing around your well-being? Has there been a bit of a, has there been something for you that, I know you work in this space, but you know what? Sometimes we say that it's the plumber who's got the leaky tap in the house.
God, yes.
Because not just you look great, but the clarity and all that, like, incredible. What have you been up to? What are your secrets?
Thanks, Mark. Well, it's a lifetime work for me. I mean, I was never into exercise until I had to be, so probably in my 30s, and then I did it kind of reluctantly. But I, in my 50s, have fallen in love with exercise, which is great. So I do. I work out about 5 times a week, and I have a dog, which my dog is 3. In the last 3 years, that has been a revolution. The dogs for my well-being has been phenomenal. I have my challenges. My family is certainly no stranger to quite severe mental ill health challenges. So I guess there's this real moment for me about a blending of my professional passion for making a difference in the sort of corporate world of employed adults with advocacy for particularly youth mental health. And in this country, the long, long path we have yet to travel to improve that. And I'm a lifelong I have been anxious from the day that my parents said to me, we're moving from Loch Earnhead to the city. I think that triggered something in me.
You know what you said before, when you said something earlier, when you said, I'm not sure if my dad put me in that cell. I reckon if I was 4 or 5, that would be etched in my bloody mind. I remember when my dad had some friends who were police, and they came to our house at one stage and they put me in the back of the car. And I shit myself, and I thought I was going off to jail. So I could only just imagine what that might have been like for you.
I could make some comments there about the difference between Victorian police in those days and Scottish police, but I won't, because you might edit that bit out.
We don't edit anything out of here except for the dogs going to the door to greet the courier driver. Let's finish off with more about you. So where can people connect with you? I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest around diagnostics and other bits and pieces. You mentioned them before, but perhaps just share again. What's the best place to tap into what you can provide?
My website is really pretty comprehensive, and I do a lot of blogging, which I post my blogs up on the website as well. So that's at glwswellbeing.com.
Yep.
LinkedIn, Audrey McGibbon, or just my email is audrey@glwswellbeing.com.
All right. Thank you very much for 10 or so years ago of asking me the sorts of questions that you raised today that maybe people are stepping away from. And the thing about you is I did get a sense when we did that work a long time ago that you weren't going to let me off the hook, and you didn't. And it's been very, very helpful for me. So thank you for that. Thanks for coming on to the podcast. And I hope we keep chatting about this important topic of well-being. Thanks, Audrey.
My pleasure, Mark.
There's no shortcut to well-being. That was the big piece for me from what Audrey had to share today, this idea that a simple and practical tool or tip is to start to live to that mantra that this isn't about finding shortcuts to getting to this. It's not, your lunch and learn and eating the right coloured vegetables, 5 different food groups, whatever it might be. It takes time, and it involves a whole lot of different areas as well. You know, she talked about this thing she calls toils, the team, organisation, the individual, the leadership, and, you know, the sort of the societal pressures and things as well. I found that fascinating. You know, that question about, are you treating yourself the way that you would treat your loved ones? They're starting with that question when you're starting to focus on what can you do to enhance your well-being. Talking about organisations that do it well because it starts from the top. And that's something that you really should think about. Are you in a position to influence those at the top, or are you at the top so that you can start to make the right calls about creating a well-being program that was less about compliance and more about care? It takes effort. It should be treated like any other strategic initiative. There needs to be resources for it. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be time. The ability to help people feel, if they do leave your organisation, that they leave on a net positive because they have felt like their well-being has been something that's been seen as important in the business. All really, really interesting things. Hey, I really encourage you to check out Audrey's website. I think there's some incredible things in there. As I said, her blog, understanding a bit more about a diagnostic, it might be something that would be useful for you to undertake and maybe take back into your organisation. Hey, if you like this, why not rate it 5 stars? And if you loved it, share it with your friends. Until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.